The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi David Eliezeri now presents his lecture, Is Free Speech Jewish?
We're going to talk today about free speech. And all of us know that free speech has been challenged a little bit here in America lately. There's been a new kind of cancel culture in this country. And it's also in other countries, sadly, which I think is a dangerous thing for us as Americans, because we understand that the concept in America of free speech, it's a very robust idea within the United States. It goes to the very core of who we are as a society. And we know that free speech is the key when you're trying to find out the truth. Because if you don't have the courage to ask hard questions, and really, in the Jewish tradition, anybody who spends time, you know, studying Talmud, you learn it's all about critical analysis and thinking for yourself. In fact, it's very intriguing that a lot of the reasons that we see such a success in the tech world in Israel is because people have grown up with this kind of sense of this culture of questioning and answering and never accepting for what it is. So free speech is very important. So what we're going to do today is look at the concept of free speech in the American context, look at within the context of Judaism, which you're going to get a little bit surprised. It's not probably exactly what you expect. And try to compare the two systems, and also ask ourselves some questions about what we can learn to apply to our own lives. Now, a lot of you guys attend JLI classes. So usually the teacher knows the people in the audience, but this time I really don't know. But I want to do this like a JLI class, so I have a mic over here. And we're going to start with reading number one, which I'm going to ask, you have to turn the mic on to do it.
U.S. Constitution, First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievance.
So when the Constitution was established, and this was a radical idea because most regimes in those days were despotic regimes primarily in Europe. And by the way, until World War I, we didn't see the monarchies of Europe, they were not really lost. And till today, there is a little different attitude about free speech here than in Europe. In many European governments, there's a much greater sense of regulation. There's much more restrictions on what you can say. For instance, there's a lot more restrictions on the issue of hate speech. Personally, I think it's good to have a law for hate speech. It's my personal opinion. Here in America, they want to say there's a hate crime. I'm very wary about those types of things because who knows what a person's thinking on the inside. We have to judge a person on his actions, not just by his intent. But nevertheless, here in America, this idea of free speech is a very important thing. And we see also differences between the United States and Europe. If you want to sue for libel in the UK, in Britain, it's much easier. Here, you got to prove actual malice. So when the New York Times writes something which isn't true, which happens on almost a daily basis, the New York Times will write something that isn't true, and you're stuck unless you can prove malice of intent in the reporter writing. A friend of mine who was a reporter in the LA Times, she wrote a piece 2 weeks ago about judicial reform in Israel, and I tell you the truth, I sent her a note. I know her for 15 years. I said, there was no nuance. You only had one point of view. You only quoted for one point of view. I mean, you were totally imbalanced. But you can't do anything about something unless you can prove malice intent. In England and other countries, the libel laws are different, and you can just prove something's untrue. Why? Because here we have an idea, for the sake of freedom, it's also okay to have a little bit of defamation. So you want to pass the mic on to the next one, to read reading number two? James Madison.
James Madison, speech to the House of Representatives. Free speech is one of the great bulwarks of liberty. It is
I never heard that word before. Indubitable. I don't know what in yeshiva we did not use that word. We didn't use a lot of other big words in English either. We used some words in Yiddish.
An indefeasible right to reform or change the U.S. government whenever it shall be found adverse to or inadequate to the purposes of its institution.
So we see here that this whole idea of free speech is a central idea, and it's very interesting when you look at Hugo Black, who was one of the great defenders of free speech. You know, here he talks about the First Amendment, how it's so important. And again, there's a tremendous difference between the American system and the European system. And one of the great champions was Justice Hugo Black from the Supreme Court. And yes? Okay, was Justice Hugo Black from the Supreme Court. And he says that only a free and unconstrained press can effectively, this is from the case of the United States versus the New York Times and the famous Pentagon Papers. We all, many of you who may remember the story of the Pentagon Papers, some of us would prefer not to be that old to remember the story of the Pentagon Papers. But nevertheless, the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers and they were sued by the United States. And he ruled, no, you have a right to publish. Why? Because we have to have, because freedom of speech is going to hold government accountable. And when government begins to stifle freedom of speech, which, by the way, seems to have happened a little bit here lately in the United States, where government told, you know, like social media companies what they should put on and what they shouldn't put on, I feel that's something which is personally very, very dangerous. Yes, sir?
For in the United States to prove defamation, whether it be slander or libel, one need prove actual malice only for a famous person or a person.
Right, you're correct.
Whereas with everyone else, it's simply the falsity of that without needing proof actual.
You are correct. You are correct about that. Excellent. That's a very, it's a correct point. So you if there's a person who's a public figure, there's a higher level of accountability. But what happens tragically is that, I mean, on the other side, sometimes things are incorrect. Sometimes media gets embarrassed. I mean, we saw this interview that was done 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago on the BBC, where the former Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, was interviewed by a reporter from BBC, and she says, well, you like killing children in Gaza? I mean, it was an outrageous interview, and the BBC, not in their character, it finally apologized. But there, you're right. There's a difference between an average citizen and a public figure. But still, in England, if you're a public figure, it's a little bit different. There's a lower level. It's easier to prove. And we know, where do we see this from? The interesting case of Arik Sharon against Time magazine, where he won the case. And this is, Time magazine wrote many years ago that he was responsible for the killing in Sabra and Shatila, which was a famous, the Christians went in and killed the Muslims in a refugee camp in Lebanon after the first Lebanese war. And he sued here in the United States. He did not win the case because he couldn't prove actual malice. He sued in Israel, and he did win the case because the libel laws are a little bit different. So Time magazine was sued in two different places, and one was a result where he won, and one is a result where he lost. So we see there is a difference between the American system, where there's a much more robust attitude toward freedom of speech, and the European system. But what we're going to do now is delve a little bit into what the Jewish system is. And in Judaism, it's very, very different. You want to take the mic the next and read reading number three. Yes.
Matthew Stone, Kent School of Law. There is no naked right to free speech in Jewish law. The reason for this glaring omission is not that Jewish law does not value speech, or that the Jewish law does not protect and recognize the social benefits of the free exchange of ideas. On the contrary, Jewish law is characterized by debate and the delicate balance between the sound majority and the perceptive minority. Each tract of the Talmud is arranged as a manuscript of arguments between rabbis of various academies debating a myriad of subjects in Jewish law and theology. The Talmudic legal system is at least as staunchly supportive of the notion of a marketplace of ideas as the American system.
So there's a fundamental core difference between the Jewish legal system and the American legal system. In America, we have a terminology of rights. How many of us, you know, have had some kind of conflict with somebody? You are my rights. The first thing an American says is you are infringing on my rights. What does a Jew say? What are my responsibilities? In Judaism, there are no such thing as rights. In Judaism, there is only responsibilities. So we have here from the very core, and this is really where what's his name, where Jewish law takes a radical departure from modern American law. In general, we have to realize we have a responsibility as Jews to follow the law of the country. There's a principle in Jewish law, dina da mechusa dina. You have to pay your taxes to the IRS, not because of the IRS may come and do an audit of you, because Torah says, unless you're living in a despotic regime, you have to go and you have to pay their taxes. There's a famous story about the holy Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Baditchev. It was Erev Pesach, it was Passover Eve in the town of Baditchev after 12 o'clock. You're not supposed to have any bread at all. And he turns to the gabbai, his assistant, and he says, find me a bagel. So he says, find me a bagel. He says, Rebbe, it's almost Pesach. I can't find a bagel. He says, geh in Stott und gefinde a Stickel Bread. Go into town and find me a piece of bread. He goes door to door. He can't find one piece of bread. He comes back. He says, Rebbe, I can't find one piece of bread. He says, find me some tobacco. Now, selling of tobacco and cigarettes and whatever was regulated by the government, and you're not supposed to sell it independently. And he goes out, and within a few minutes, he comes back with all the tobacco you could want. And so Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Baditchev turns, he says, Master of the universe, God, you gave the Torah Mount Sinai over 3,000 years ago, and we can't find one piece of bread in town. But the Tsar has armies and soldiers and whatever, and he says, a Jew can't trade in tobacco. They're all trading in tobacco. What's the difference? That was a despotic regime. In a despotic regime, things are different. But in a normal country where people are treated with rights and responsibilities, we have an obligation called dina de machusa dina. The law of the land is the law of the land, and we have to pay our taxes not because it's something that we want to do. It's because Torah says. I'll share with you a beautiful story that I heard from the Bala Maisa from the story itself. Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, who was the Rebbe's secretary, one day went into the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said he was going to the store, to the office supply store up at Kingston Avenue, and the Rebbe said, I need a few personal items. And he gave him $20, whatever it was. So he goes into the store, and in New York, you do not pay sales tax for a nonprofit organization. Here we live in California, they tax you for everything. Let me tell you, they tax you when you breathe, when you move, when you come, when you go. They have new taxes. If you leave California, they're thinking of taxing you for the next 20 years. It's exciting. Anyway, religious organizations, nonprofits pay sales tax in California. But in the state of New York, you don't pay sales tax. So he goes to the store, he purchases the items, he purchases for the Chabad organization, and he purchases for the Rebbe, and he comes back and he gives the Rebbe his change and his receipt. And the Rebbe looks at the receipt, it's like, spent $5, he says, what about the tax? He says, I was buying something for the organization, so they didn't charge me tax. So I guess when I also bought the other items for the Rebbe, they didn't charge tax. The Rebbe says, I owe 25 cents, a dollar, whatever it was in tax, go back to the store and pay the tax. I heard the story from Rabbi Krinsky, who it happened to. That's the level to aspire to as Jews that live in America, that we have to, you know, follow the dictates of the country. But nevertheless, that what is the core idea over here is that in Judaism, we have privileges, we have responsibilities, and we look at speech as part of our responsibility of how we speak to somebody else. And in America, we have rights, and Judaism is a language of positive, active obligations, not rights. And it's looking at things fundamentally different. And when we take that, we understand that foundational principle, then we can see where the divergence is. Do you want to pass the mic to the next person? Yes. You want to read to us reading number 4.
Both American and Jewish law recognize that words are powerful and can accomplish social reform or further a political agenda. The difference between the two philosophies is that Jewish law is more willing to make the tough decisions about what is valuable speech and what is disrespectful. American law's most important goal concerning speech is to protect the ability of the minority opinion to be heard in the marketplace of ideas, even if expressing those views may be hurtful or offensive to some. Talmudic law's most important goal in speech law is to fulfill the will of God. Thus, the Talmud sees no problem protecting the core ideals of Judaism from disrespectful criticism. Preserving the decorum of the marketplace, as it were, even at the expense of certain views being excluded.
So we have an idea in Judaism that certain speech is not considered acceptable, and that we shouldn't say that kind of speech. And we have a responsibility not to speak that way. By the way, there is no punishment in Jewish law for if you speak improperly. You don't go to the corner, you don't go to jail, you don't get lashes, you don't do this, you don't have to offer a sacrifice. You're doing something which is considered improper. There's no enforcement in Judaism. There is other things in Judaism, one second, where there is a reaction, you know, that you could be punished in a certain way for doing something which is wrong. When it comes to speech, that's not true. Yes, ma'am. There is a spiritual punishment, but not a punishment in court in this world. That's the difference. We say God can give us a punishment, but we can't give us a punishment. So we see here a divergence. And we have to also understand what is the power of speech. And it's a very interesting concept. We say that the world is made up of four foundational principles, four elements. And I'll say them in Hebrew and then explain them into what's his name. Doimim, Sameach, Chayim, Medaber. Dormant things, which is the ground, dirt, etc. Sameach, which means growing things, living things. And then comes the interesting term. And by the way, JLI is having a course in the fall in Kabbalah. Some of you may want to attend that course in your local communities. But the human beings are defined in a very unique way. They're not called ben onish, a person. They're called a medaber, a communicator. What makes us special as people, our connection one to another, that we can articulate an idea and the other person can benefit from what that idea has to say. And people, by nature, they need community. They need connections. They get married. They have children. They have family. The very core of who we are as a human being is one who communicates to another, which is one of the qualities that makes us special and unique. So the Torah, when it comes to define human beings, we call that a medaber, a communicator. Because we see the power of speech. Now, if you take this one step further in a Kabbalistic context, what is the terminology in the Torah for the act of creation? It's God spoke. V'yadaber Hashem, God speaks and he creates this and he creates that. And he said, each one of those idea of speaking, it's an anthropomorphic way of expressing what God is doing, is that he's bringing, and God, by the way, transcends being a he or a she, so I don't want to get in trouble over here, okay, but whatever it is, but God is bringing into the world a sense of spiritual energy. And that spiritual energy, the term we use to explain what that is speech, is God is speaking. So we see that God said, let there be light, and there was light. So we see, number one, how we act, how we are defined as human beings, the terminology of Kabbalah is as a communicator. And number two, the power of speech. The power of speech which we have is something, the power of the idea of speech is not on a more spiritual and deeper level, is the idea how God creates the world. So now, but it comes now into Jewish law, there is a difference. In America, Jewish law will make tough decisions about speech and saying what's valuable and what's disrespectful. So for instance, I'm just going to read reading number 6 and reading number 7. It says, you shall not take God's name in vain and honor your mother and father. In other words, how you speak, you don't take God's name and use it in an improper fashion. We don't speak disrespectfully to our parents. There are certain kinds of regulations. And also, we're going to touch a little bit later, we're going to touch about the idea of what's his name, of Lashon Hara, and what it means to have bad speech. But there can be a regulation of speech. Now, in the Talmud, there is an active Talmudic debate, and we're going to get into that, what the limits of that debate are in a few moments. But there is a willingness within Judaism to say, no, there should be, it's not cancel culture, which says you don't have a right to have your opinion. Because within the context of Judaism, there is argument. But there's also the idea that speech can be damaging when it's done in a disrespectful fashion. I would tell you one of the most interesting challenges that I personally find is to agree to disagree with somebody who you don't agree with in a decent menschliche fashion. And there's a tendency today in American culture. And this happened to me in Israel recently. I was in Israel actually a few times the last couple of months, but just before after Pesach, I was at a conference in Israel. And Israel is very much intense about this issue of judicial reform. And at the conference I was, there was a private session done with the guy who was the architect of judicial reform. And at the same conference was a bunch of people from the other side of the political spectrum, from the much more liberal side of the political spectrum. And they came marching down the hall to disrupt, God forbid, that this guy should have the ability to speak. And I went outside and I saw one of the, I don't want to say the name, but a guy that I happen to do like, he's a very prominent Jewish liberal leader in America. And I said to him, Josh, this is the way you act one Jew to another. You disagree, I have no problem with that. Did I ever disrespect you, even though theologically we have tremendous disagreements? He says, no. And he backed down. And the rest of them continued to act in a disgusting fashion. And I told him that the mitzvah of Avos Yisrael is to love the Jew you don't agree with. It's easy to love the Jew that you like. It's hard to love the Jew you don't like, and it's much harder to love the person that you don't agree with. And treat him with respect, even if you don't agree with their positions. So there's this balancing act that we have. On one level, we want to say there should be some kind of limitation on speech that can be degrading about how we speak to our parents, not saying God's name in vain, or not saying certain things bad about other people. And even when we speak about other people, and we're going to get to it a little bit toward the end of the class today, a very interesting story that happened to me about speech, that we have to understand about what those limitations and what it comes down to. Where is the core of the difference? As we said before, it's rights versus duties, responsibilities, privileges versus what we think we own. Americans come to everything with a sense, it's kup mir in Yiddish, it's my right. Which, by the way, we as Jews in America have been benefited tremendously from the Bill of Rights. This is the first country in the history of mankind that gave us full religious freedom. Never before. And even when Napoleon wanted to give religious freedom a little bit in France, it was a conditional freedom. You got to be good Frenchmen, you got to listen to what I have to say. The first place that really gave us religious freedom was this country, and in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. So while we're benefiting from that, we have to realize that our core attitude is something very different. It's about our responsibilities to other, because it's what's his name? And if you look at Jewish law today, you'd end up probably banning about 90% of the internet and part of a good percentage of what's written in newspapers. Why? Because it could be degrading of another person. And we're very concerned about speech, which is degrading another person, especially torturous speech, which can be so. So I want to take this now to one other, a few other points that we want to get into today, which is about the power of speech. Who has the microphone there? Yeah, okay, so you want to read to us reading number 7.
If a person claims to be a prophet but is merely lying and telling a false prophecy, that person is liable for death.
There is the idea in Judaism, and if you open up the Code of Jewish Law, there is a series of laws, Maimonides' Code of Jewish Law deals with this in depth, about the laws of being a prophet. We have an idea about what it means to be a prophet. But there is somebody who comes along and he claims to be a prophet when he's not. He's called a Novi Sheker. In other words, he's using speech in a more profane way, because he's saying he's speaking in the name of God, which is a very serious thing to do. Now, we are now past the time of Nevuah, which is the period of prophecy that ended at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. The last, so to speak, act of prophecy we have is the Book of Esther. And the last, at the very beginning of the Second Temple period, which is about 2,400 years ago, was the end of the age of prophecy. There were many prophets that were not enumerated within the books of the Tanakh, of the Ksuvim, the prophets and the writings, etc., because only the ones that had lessons to teach us are there enumerated. But what happens when a guy got up there and he says, you know what, I have, God made me a revelation and I have what to tell you, etc., he's called a Navi Sheker. And a Navi Sheker has a very serious, in Judaism, is a very serious offense. Now, to be a prophet, you have to be the proper person. You have to say, there's a very interesting concept in Jewish law about prophecy. If a prophet comes along and says something good is going to happen, it has to happen. If a prophet comes along and says something bad is going to happen, but it happens good, well, maybe God changed the decree and he decided to make it good. But if he says something good's going to happen and it doesn't happen, he's a Navi Sheker, he's a false prophet. So if you look at Maimonides' Code of Jewish Law, you can look at it on Chabad.org. It has everything is printed there. You can listen to Rabbi Gordon's classes on the laws of a prophet, but they're there in detail. But this is idea of how speech is being used in an improper fashion. Reading number 8.
Okay.
Let me set the tone for what's happening here. There was a great debate in the Talmud. Some of you may have encountered this debate before. And we're just going to go over the idea of, because it shows the level of what dissension is within Judaism. There was a great debate in the Talmud about if a certain kind of oven was considered spiritually pure and impure. And Rabbi Eliezer had this debate with the sages. So read it, and then we'll explain it.
Rabbi Eliezer was free to debate fiercely with the sages, but was obligated to accept their ruling insofar as he could not continue to teach his own views as the proper halakha. This is the Talmudic approach to free speech in a marketplace of ideas. When a debate rages in the marketplace, anyone may give his opinion, but only so long as the debate remains in the marketplace. Once the majority has passed judgment, their ruling has very real consequences. For example, about whether an oven may be used or must be thrown away, at that point, a scholar may not teach his own opinion as law. If he does so, he is deemed a rebellious sage and may be liable for death in certain circumstances. To be clear, a sage may say that in his opinion, The ruling should have gone another way, but he may not say that the majority is wrong.
So let me just tell you the story of the Talmud. Some of you may have heard it. What happened was the sages and Rabbi Elazar were having a big argument. They were saying this tanur, this oven, was spiritually unclean. I don't want to get into the guts of that whole story. We could spend another couple of hours here. So Rabbi Elazar said, come on, I'm right. He says, the sages says, no, you're not. He says, well, let me show you. God's going to prove it's true. He says, let the tree move, and the tree moves. And then he says, let a voice come from heaven, and a voice comes from heaven. So Rabbi Elazar's right. And the sages says, forget it. No, the Torah was given to man. We're supposed to define what the law is. We don't agree with you. We're the majority. You're out. So there's a lot to do in the, this is a very interesting question about the concept of Masorah, of Jewish tradition, which actually I'm going to give a class on Shabbos morning about why Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Torah, and we're going to discuss a little bit about this idea of Jewish tradition, how Jewish tradition works. But the main point is, while the debate's going on, everybody has a right to express an opinion. Once the debate is finished, you have to accept the ruling of the sages of the majority. Even if you disagree, you can say, I don't agree, but I accept the ruling. Otherwise, you're considered a rebellious sage, and the court can make all kinds of sanctions against you. So in a sense, there is a limitation on that speech. Probably the same thing as somebody in a government today. If you vote for something in a government, and the government rules, or the Supreme Court would rule, lahavdil, I mean, the Jewish court is different than American court, but the Jewish court, but nevertheless, they make a ruling, we as citizens have an obligation to follow the rule of the land. I want to take a step further, because I want to get into how we're looking at this on a more deeper, on a more philosophical basis, on what is considered evil speech. So who has the mic next? Want to pass it to somebody behind you? Which is number 9.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay.
Number 9. The prohibition against speaking Lashon Hara, evil speech, is the most important commandment for a Jew to keep in the face of modern culture.
So here we have something which is very important, which is the prohibition about Lashon Hara, which means in Hebrew bad speech or negative speech, against not speaking against somebody else in a negative kind of way, not sharing things which are considered improper. And it says something very interesting statement in the Talmud. It says a person who says Lashon Hara, a person who says evil speech against somebody else, denies God. So how do you deny God if you speak against another person? And the answer is that each human being, I'm not talking about, there's certain times that you have to say bad things. Let's say somebody comes to you and says, I'm thinking about making a business partnership with Mr. Stein, you know, with this guy Jack down the block. And you know that this guy is not a reliable person. So you have an obligation to prevent him from going into a bad, to go into business with somebody who's dishonest. But in general, when you just speak about people in a negative kind of way, each human being is created in the image of God. So in a sense, when you're degrading another human being, you're degrading somebody who is created by God. And I'll tell you what's really, it bothers me. You know, you saw a lot of times you hear people speak about politics in this country or in other countries, and they'll say, this guy's this, and this guy's that. People love to, the person they don't agree with, they like to say, he's this, you know, he's, well, this one's a fascist, this one's a robber, this one's a stealer. And I tell people like this, because first thing in our little Chabad center in Orange County, try to keep the place to be non-political as possible. But I tell people something like this. I always tell them, I said, unless you met the guy, how do you know what he's really like? Maybe you may not agree with him, but who says he's this evil, terrible kind of person you want? So I said, I have a rule to myself that unless I met a politician or I know somebody who knows him well, I'm not going to speak against them. The Rebbe said a very interesting thing. I never speak against people, I only speak against ideas. This is a very powerful idea. And I tell you the truth, I had an experience about 4 or 5 years ago that really surprised me. I was invited in a private meeting in New York with five people there, to meet with Yair Lapid, who's now today the head of the opposition. As you can realize, I wouldn't necessarily vote for Yair Lapid if I happened to live in Israel. He's too secular for me. He's a little bit hostile on religious issues. Not my cup of tea. So I sat down and I met with him for an hour and a half with 3-4 other people, and it was a very blunt conversation. I mean, there was no holds barred. I told him, Yair, I was really straight with the guy. And I walked out of the room, and I was surprised. Because I said afterwards to people that after about the experience that I didn't agree with him, but I believed he was a principled person in what he believed in, and I happened to like him, and I had 2 tickets to a Yankee game, I'd even take him. In other words, I liked him as a person, I didn't agree with his philosophy. And there's a very big danger here in this country in particular, you know, that about how we speak about people, we have a tendency to degrade that person we don't agree with. And I think it's a very dangerous thing, and we have to speak about their ideas. And that is something I try very hard not to do. And also, I'll tell you a story about treating people with respect. There's an Israeli political party that, thank God, in my opinion, did not make it in the last election called Meretz. It's a hard left. It makes Bernie Sanders look like a right-wing guy. And the woman who was the head of it for many years was a woman called Shulamit Aloni. She was Minister of Education. We're going back 30, 40 years in Israel. Shulamit Aloni was a name as the head of Meretz. She was a super lefty. And what happens is the Rebbe had a man in Israel. His name is Shlomka Medanchik. He's since passed away. He was the mayor of Far Chabad. And to give you a sense about Shlomka, if you ever go into the airport in Ben Gurion Airport, when you come into the main departure lounge on the right side, there's a big tefillin booth. Shlomka's son, who's my classmate in Yeshiva Nachman, he runs the tefillin booth. And the Israeli airport is the Hamashug in the place. I went to about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, there was a war in Israel, and I flew into Israel to visit soldiers on the front lines. I had a lot of cash on me because I was going to buy iPads to bring to all the, there was 70 wounded soldiers in the hospital near Tel Aviv. And they never asked me a question ever in my life when I come into Israel, but when twice in my life I've come in carrying a lot of cash because I'm going to see soldiers. So 5 years ago, I come into the country, I'm carrying almost $20,000 in cash. And I actually filled out I took the American form. You're supposed to fill out a form in America when you take more than $10,000 in the country. I downloaded the form, filled it out, but I didn't know who to give to, so I left it in my pocket. So I'm going through the green line over the airport, and the guy comes over to me and says, Yishcha me'elef shekel muzuman. He's a tough Israeli guy. He says, you have 100,000 shekel in cash. So I really a little ticked at him. There's a war. Obama had made a ban on flying to Israel. This was one of the first flights that came in. There's nobody on the plane, just me, a few other Mishugoyim coming to this country in the middle of a war. You know, it's about 6 years ago. And I'm carrying about $18,000, $20,000 cash, and I've ordered 75 iPad minis in Kfar Chabad in the electronics store. I'm going to pick them up and go to the hospital. So I told the guy, I said to him in Hebrew, how much is it in dollars? You want to be tough Israeli? I'll be tough American. So he tells me 25,000. So I got about 18,20, I tell him. I said, you know why I have the money? He says, why? I said, because I'm going straight to Kfar Chabad and I'm buying the iPads and I'm going to the hospital to bring to the wounded soldiers. So the guy who wants to put me in jail says to me, Kol hakavod lecha, all the honor to you, and I just put on tefillin with Rav Nachman. I just put on tefillin with my classmate, Rav Nachman Medanchik. Anyway, Shlomka is in Israel. And he gets from the Rebbe, sends him a letter addressed to Shulamit Aloni, a Rosh Hashanah letter, wishing her a good year. And the Rebbe asks Shlomka, go deliver it in person. Now think about this. She is on the other side of the political spectrum. He is advocating Jews should live in Judea and Samaria. He is pretty religious. She is anti-religious. She is secular. She is lefty. It couldn't be a bigger division. He might send her a letter in the mail because he had some kind of connection, wouldn't wish you a good year. He says, no, I'm sending the letter to my man in Israel. He should go to the office and present it to her in the office. And that's what he did. And that shows how you respect somebody who you don't agree with, because you value them as a human being. And tragically, in our time, in this country here, and you see this also in Israel, especially now with the conflict over judicial reform, that we're losing that ability to talk to people that we don't agree with and speak to them in a meshlach fashion. And I think this is, when it comes down to this issue of Lashon Hara, I think this is something all of us need to work on, especially with the politicians that we don't agree with. Speak to about them, disagree with their ideas, strongly, not viciously, not violently, God forbid. And it happened to me just a few weeks ago. I was in Israel just after Pesach, And strangely enough, I'm at this conference, the Jewish Federation conference, and there's these guys protesting from this group called Achim LeNeshek, which means brothers in arms, and they're the leaders of the anti-judicial reform protest in Israel. And personally, I know a lot about judicial reform. I'm very much for it, but that's beside the point. And I sat down with a guy. I was thinking, eating something. Guy sits down next to me. I didn't know who he was. And I started to have this long conversation with him for almost 45 minutes. Afterwards, I Googled him. He's a lawyer in Tel Aviv. And it turns out he's one of the leaders of the opposition. He says, what's your red line? I told him, saying that you won't go to the army. But suddenly I had a common ground with a guy that I just didn't agree with. Why? Because we spoke like mention to each other. So Lashon Hara teaches us about this whole idea about how we need to speak, which is very important. And then that says also, I'm going to add the other two things that weren't read before. All my life I found nothing wiser than silence, and one should not speak about somebody else who's wiser. In other words, sometimes you have to learn to be quiet and listen. And you learn a lot when you're listening to other people. And number two, when somebody else is speaking, don't interrupt them. Treat them with a little bit of respect. So this whole idea of Lashon Hara, it's a very, I think there's something here we can, the basic value about how we act, I think, which is very, very important. So who has the mic? Okay, you want to read to us the next line, which is number 10.
When you hear a bad report about a person, it should pain you so much that you do not want to listen, or it's so troubling that they don't want to believe it.
So this is a line from the Baal Shem Tov. It's a very interesting line. You know, a lot of times we seem to relish that bad news. Did you hear what happened with so-and-so? And the Baal Shem Tov here is telling us something very, very powerful. Either you don't believe it, or you don't want to hear it. You don't want, sometimes you have to believe it because we also have to be realistic and we need to know about sometimes you have to listen to something. And as I mentioned, the question is how do we approach this? Are we relishing that conversation? The question is when you hear what the tendency of many people is to speak bad about another person and to right away take it. So the Baal Shem Tov comes and he says to us, listen, either you don't believe it or you don't want to listen. Now there is an exception to this and this is very important. Let's say you know this girl is thinking going out with this boy. This is similar to what I said before. Or somebody's suggesting somebody go into business with somebody. And you know it can cause damage to that person. Then you have an obligation to quietly, in a diplomatic kind of way, to do something to make sure that your friend does not get into trouble or into a problem, that a girl doesn't get stuck with a guy that in the end turns out to be an axe murderer or whatever it may be. You know, whatever it may be. You have that responsibility to act in that kind of fashion to make sure that doesn't happen. But short of that, we have to, what's his name? We have to be very careful about what we say and how we speak. And the Torah is very strong about this issue of Lashon Hara, about speaking about other people with respect and with dignity and with menschlichkeit, to also learn to disagree. Let's read reading number 11.
Whoever speaks with an evil tongue, they say it is if he denied God. They also say it is forbidden to dwell in the vicinity of any of those with an evil tongue, and all the more so to sit with them and listen to their words.
And so what happens is a lot of times we cause this, it's like, I have a neighbor, a very good friend of my wife, whenever somebody talks negatively about something, she shifts the conversation. She doesn't want to participate in it. And we can either draw the person in, and we can get all, they say in Yiddish, verhitzt, excited, and we can talk about these things, and we can discuss them, and make them feel they're important. Or we can say, you know, I just don't want to hear that. Can we talk about something else? Let me tell you about the Yankee game. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't speak about important issues. Because there, and we can also speak about more important philosophical and spiritual issues. But the point is that when we allow ourselves to be participatory in this kind of conversation, we are bringing ourselves down. And it's like, as I mentioned before, denying God. Why? Because you are talking about other human beings that are created by God. So we have to be very, very careful about how we speak and how we act to one person and realize what the power of speech is all about. And because otherwise, we end up in a very counterproductive relationship. And we know all of us know people that all they want to do is speak about what's wrong with this one, what's wrong with that one, and how this should be and how that should be. We all have those kinds of people that we have those kinds of relationships with. We happen to know. And if we turn them a little bit, and we try to go with a higher kind of fashion, then what's going to happen is we're going to elevate them, and we're also going to elevate ourselves. And because we know speech is just centrally important. And also look at a relationship between husbands and wives. Sometimes the wife can say something to the husband, it's very upsetting, and what he does, he reacts in a very harsh way, and within 3 minutes, World War III is going out, and the police are there, and excitement is coming, and divorce court, and all the kind of thing. He could smile at her and say, ah, honey, I don't go. It's not exactly the way it should be. Why don't you think a little differently? With one little schmechel, with one little smile, he can diffuse. Or he can spend 3 weeks in World War III. He's sleeping upstairs, she's sleeping downstairs. The kids are coming to negotiate, you know what I mean? Things are terrible. You know, the old story, the guy calls up the kids. He says, they're having the 15th wedding anniversary, and he tells the kids, listen, calls them up in Chicago, and he's in Miami. He says, listen, we're getting divorced. Screaming and yelling, the kids say, you can't do this. How come you're going to get divorced? She says, we're coming right away. So he gets off the phone, he turns to his wife, he says, the kids are coming for Pesach. But what happens here is, it's how we react and how we act. You know, and you know, I have, Baruch Hashem, beautiful, 6 married children. I got a lot of grandchildren. They're all very much cuter than their parents, much nicer than their parents. That's not evil speech, that's truthful speech. You can tell their parents what I said, it's okay. They all know it. Anyway, once you have the grandchildren, you figured I could have skipped the kids. It would have been much nicer. So, anyway, but it's how we turn that conversation, which so much can be so much different. And it's important. So reading number 12 basically says what I said to you before, but I want to tell you all a little story that happened to me that became a very important lesson in my life. This was, you know, in life you get different lessons. Many years ago, many moons ago, this is in mid-1970s, I was just a young kid out of yeshiva, and I wrote a series of articles. There was a Chabad magazine that came out in those days called the Yiddish Heim, which means the Jewish home. So one half of the magazine was in Yiddish, the other half of the magazine was in English. And the editor was a wonderful woman called Rachel Altheim, lived in the Bronx. She and her husband. Her husband actually was the first person the previous Rebbe ever sent to be a shliach. On Pearl Harbor Day, 1941, the previous Rebbe sent him, he was still single, to Pittsburgh to start on working on opening a yeshiva in Pittsburgh. It's all a story into itself. If you read my book, The Secret of Chabad, it's all in the book. Anyway, that's a shameless plug. Anyway, so I write this article. I actually wrote a series of articles. So in those days, the payoff, and I have lost this. It's lost the history. I could sell it on eBay for a lot of money. Mrs. Altheim, Rebbetzin Altheim, her father was Rabbi Yisrael Jacobson, who was the seminal figure in bringing Chabad to America. Established the first Chabad organization in the 1920s here. Had a lot to do with saving the previous Rebbe in World War II, and also in 1927. And what happens is the payoff was, is that in those days, the Rebbe would review the articles that you wrote in English, and he would make corrections. So you had an editor. He was the editor. And you would get back the corrections with pencil writing. Now, I have lost these corrections. I could have paid for my children's weddings by selling the corrections, you know, on eBay. So I wrote this article, and I wrote at the time that the hippie movement died out. A regular term, you know, this was, don't forget, late 60s, this is mid-70s, late 70s, I guess it was late 70s I wrote it, and we know about the hippie movement, which actually the Rebbe spoke very interesting in those days, that the hippie movement was a statement of rebellion and individualism, and we can see these are people who standing up to the normal to values of society because they're seeking truth, and that has a great value, which I think is quite different than what's going on today in America, that we're trying to categorize people on the color of the skin rather than the quality of their character, which is a much more dangerous thing. The revolution's going on right now, I think, is much more dangerous for American society. That was a revolution, he said, that people were, you know, they were rejecting certain things and they were asking for truth. And I think in this revolution, tragically, we're not asking for truth, which is sad. So I get the corrections back from the Rebbe, and in this whole article, I criticize what we're doing and this and that and, you know, all kinds of different things. There's only one word that the Rebbe corrects. He takes the word died, he crosses it out, he puts the word waned. Now, there's a Gemara. The Talmud tells us something very interesting called Lashon Nekiyah that tells us we have to speak in a purified fashion. So much so, it says you're not supposed to say a person died, you have to say he's not alive anymore. He passed away. You're not supposed to say he's bad. It's not good. There's a sense of having purity of speech. This is a higher level than Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara means I'm not going to say, you heard what Yankel did with Schmerl. They did this corrupt business deal, and they did this, and they did that, or et cetera, whatever. Or this one, this politician is elite, is that, and this politician is that, and this one is that. That's Lashon Hara. This is a much more kind of refined level about how we speak should be in a refined fashion. And here comes, and how am I, what am I writing about? Am I writing about a great Talmudic scholar? We're writing about, you know, were you writing about Rabbi Akiva or something like this? No. We're writing about the hippie movement. It ain't the fancy, you know, come on. This is what you're worried about. And he crosses out the word died and writes the word waned. And the lesson to me, which was, you know, these lessons in life that sometimes set you in direction, so to speak, was how you speak is very, very important. It waned out. It didn't die out. And this is the higher level of the power of speech. This was the Rebbe's correction, which I lost in pencil. So this tells us, this is a little bit of an insight about how far we need to go. So number one, we have to realize that we have a responsibility to speak in a positive kind of way, and just disagree with people. There's no problem with that. That's fine. It's healthy to disagree. But treat that person who you don't agree with a sense of dignity. It's important to use words and realize the power of speech, which is a very powerful thing that we have. But also we have to understand how the style of speech that we have to have, which is also very, very important. And we have to know that there is something else that happens with speech. Because life and death are in the hands of the tongue. Because a lot of times things that happen, something bad happens, a misunderstanding, whatever, terrible things can happen. People get angry, you can raise a hand against another because of that, because somebody gets very emotional, they can shoot, God forbid, people can murder somebody or mistreat somebody, whatever. Speech has a very thing, the Talmud says a very interesting thing. He said, there's a story in the Talmud about that somebody went and sped bad speech about somebody else. So he said, an arrow shot in Damascus, if I remember the terminology, the arrow shot in Jerusalem can pierce the heart of somebody in Damascus. When you say something, now today it's much different. Why? Because we have a thing called WhatsApp, for social media, and we have to be a little extra careful. I personally are extremely careful about what I write on my Facebook pages. I write Mazel Tovs and Nachas, and I did here, and I went there, and I saw my grandchildren, and I live happily ever after, and I went to the retreat. But I am extremely careful about anything. Why? Because everything you write can have an impact. And I'll tell you a story that happened to me. About 15 years ago, we had a conflict in a Jewish community in Europe. And a certain major Jewish organization, in my opinion, was acting in an irreputable fashion in the way it was treating the local Chabad shliach. I don't want to go into the country and whatever. And they were going to have a conference of European Jewry, whatever, and I was very upset with what this organization did, and I wrote a very threatening email. Like, we're mad at you, and we're going to do this to you, and we're going to do that to you, and blah, blah. I was very angry, because what they did to the local shliach was disgusting and despicable, to be very honest. Anyway, one of the other Chabad rabbis, a little smarter than me, a little more experienced, he says to me, David, this is going to come to hurt us. Well, they had their conference, and guess what the main topic of the conference was? My threatening email. Because I wasn't too smart, because I reacted emotionally. I should have written something I don't agree, or I should have called the guy on the phone and spoke to him. But we have to realize, especially nowadays, about the power that we have when we write something. It can be there forever. You can't necessarily delete it all the time. So that makes today even, and the sense sometimes we have is we get upset about something, I'm sending him an email or a WhatsApp or something like this. And young people in particular could do things, you know, on the, like TikTok and things like this, let's say, are far from modest to be used in a diplomatic fashion. I only recently discovered a TikTok. I really don't know what it is yet. But I'm working on WhatsApp and Facebook, but I guess everybody over 50 goes on Facebook. That's what they tell me nowadays. But we have to understand the power that we have, and when we write something which isn't good, it can be very hurtful to somebody else, and it can be there for many, many years to happen. So I would encourage people to think twice before we react in a gutsy kind of way. So that's why I'm very careful. Like, if you, the only thing I write on Facebook, somebody else's Facebook has a birthday, mazel tov, have nachas, whatever. And in my stuff, I'm very, very careful. You know, we had a nice party in the shul last night. I went to the National Jewish Retreat. We did this, we did that. I'm very, why? Because everybody is watching and everybody is looking today. You know, last week I took a vacation with my wife. I didn't tell anybody where I went. I didn't take one picture on Facebook. I didn't want people nudging where you went, where you didn't go, et cetera, because the whole world is public today. And some people have nothing what to do except they're putting a picture up in every 5 minutes. So we have to realize the power of speech. We have to realize there is a difference in Judaism in America. In America, for our sake, and I'm happy with freedom of speech. I'm a big believer of freedom of speech. And I am scared lately how there's a stifling of speech in the American society, that certain opinions are considered beyond the pale, which is very, very... And I had this experience in Israel where I ended up, you know, in some sessions where the guy who was the architect of the Jewish reform was screamed and yelled at and disrespected. If you didn't agree with him, that's fine. But treat him with a sense of respect. And I was shocked with what happened. I even wrote a piece after that happened in the Jerusalem Post criticizing in a very nice way and in a way which was what's him. And I'll share with you one story that happened, one more story to me, and then we have a few moments for questions, which also was a lesson to me in how we speak about speech. About a year ago, there was an event at the Kotel in Jerusalem in the non-halachic section where some yeshiva students went and attacked somebody doing a bar mitzvah that was men and women mixed, and they acted in a very despicable fashion. So one prominent Jewish liberal leader, one of the most important ones in America, was a very close personal friend of mine. He got out and said some very critical things about the Orthodox rabbis and Jews. It was very critical and very harsh. I was very upset with the guy. So I wrote an article criticizing him in the Jerusalem Post. He's like, how could he say such a thing, blah, 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 blah. And then I wrote, I said, who the heck is he to speak the way he is? Last year, when there was a war in Israel in May, there was a bunch of rabbinical students in the Reform and the Reconstructionists, a little bit the conservative, who said they sided with Hamas and criticized Israel. So who is he, a prominent liberal Jewish leader, to speak about the Orthodox? That's what his people are doing. So I write that piece. Now, we happen to be at a conference together in Jerusalem, so it gets more exciting. So I wake up in the morning, and I read the piece, and I said to myself, the criticism of him, the other part of it was very menschlich. It criticized his ideas. I didn't do it personally. But the piece about the rabbinical students was wrong. Because I was angry, and I acted with anger. So I come down to the lobby of the Orient Hotel. I have a meeting in one. This is the board of governors of the Jewish agency. Most of the exact big activities happen in the lobby. He's sitting on one corner. I'm going to a meeting in the other corner. I walk over to him. I said, listen, my friend. I don't want to say his name. I said, I wrote this piece, and I decided to stick it to you, and I was wrong, and I apologize. My criticism of you stands, but the piece about the rabbinical students was wrong to put in the article because it was disrespectful, and I shouldn't have done it. He said, I hadn't read the article. I said, read it. So I go to my table, we have a meeting, he walks over to me afterwards, he says, David, I don't agree with you one bit, but I still love you. The point is, and that was a lesson to me because I overreached. I acted in a disrespectful fashion. So the point is that we need to learn to disagree with dignity and respect, especially the people we don't agree with. And we need to speak to them role models about how we disagree with dignity and respect, because then they're going to value our opinion even more, and they're going to act in a more dignified fashion to us. And that is something which is very, very important, how we have to do. So what does the Torah tell us most importantly? Yes, we believe in America's free speech, but in Judaism it teaches us about responsibility. The responsibility to speak to another with dignity, with love, and in particular to speak to that person that we don't agree with the same sense of dignity and respect. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.